morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Andrew Lowe of MIT about the question, can financial engineering cure cancer, solve the energy crisis, and stop global warming? I'd like now to welcome to the program Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a pediatrician. She's a congressional fellow with Physicians for a National Health Program. And Dr. Bruce Trigg. He is a retired public health doctor. He's chair of the New Mexico Network of Health Professionals for a National Health Program. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So both of you are advocates of something which didn't even get discussed during our national health care debate, virtually didn't get discussed, at least on a congressional level and in the White House, namely a national single-payer health care system. Let's just start with the big question. Why a single-payer system?
Well, we're the only industrialized nation that doesn't have a health care system, so we don't really have a system within which to allocate our health resources so that everybody can get the care they need. We don't have a universal health care system. And as a result of using this kind of mishmash of private insurances and public insurances that we have the most expensive system, most complicated system. It's leading to tens of thousands of people suffering unnecessarily, dying of preventable causes, physicians, you know, and other health professionals having a difficult time practicing in this kind of environment. And so it's really doing us a disservice as a nation, and we think it's time to change that. And the patches that we've tried over the last few decades to patch together the current situation have just failed. So we are saying it's time to end this and join the civilized world and have a real health system.
As a physician, I see every day that our healthcare system is not designed in the interest of patients. It's designed for everyone else's convenience and monetary gain. It's a system that's designed for making money for corporations, for CEOs, for stockholders, for companies. It's not designed for the people who need medical care.
And even doctors, who we usually think of as very privileged and often, if not wealthy, at least well-to-do people, are kind of falling down on the economic scale, especially people who practice the kind of medicine that the two of you have practiced, public health and pediatrics.
Absolutely. Yeah, and private practice is really deteriorating in this country. Fewer and fewer doctors are able to make it in the private practice world. And, you know, I come across doctors in my travels all around who say, I'm doing everything right. I'm trying to do the best I can, and my practice is failing. What am I supposed to do?
What did that look like, Margaret, for you? I mean, you have actually left the practice of medicine, at least for the moment. What did you encounter in your own practice?
Right. So, you know, when I did my training, I felt like I had a very good training. I'd worked very hard. And when I finished and went into actual practice, I was looking forward to using the knowledge that I had gained to provide the best care for my patients. And instead, what I kept running into was this situation where the insurance companies dictate what care we can and cannot give to our patients. And so as a physician, you start trying to find ways to work around that system, to, you know, use the wording that you use in the chart to try to make, you know, word it in a way that the insurance companies will cover it. You know, it undermines your integrity as a physician when you're having to work around this system that's designed, as Bruce said, towards creating profit for a corporation, not creating better health. And then in my personal private practice, because of the difficulties that we ran into with trying to get reimbursed from the private insurance companies, and there's really no control. You don't have any ability to negotiate with them. So people are squeezed, the patients are squeezed, the physicians are squeezed too. Was being driven into a model of practice where I was told that I needed to spend less and less time with my patients. If they had more than one complaint, they were going to have to schedule another appointment to talk about that. That means parents have to take off work, children have to take off school. I just found this really unacceptable.
So they had a stomach ache and a headache, you had to make two different appointments?
Right, we could only talk about one issue, yeah.
could happen.
I was supposed to say, I'm sorry, I can't talk with you about that on this visit. Would you please go out and make another appointment?
And then they get mad because it's another copay and it's another day off of work.
Absolutely. That wasn't what I went into practice for. And the worry that they have to go through in the intervening time. And that was designed around economics, not around, as Bruce said, what the patient's needs are.
Well, my experience was completely opposite because I had the privilege of working for my whole career in socialized healthcare systems, the Indian Health Service in New Mexico, and then for the State Department of Health. So I never had to do a wallet biopsy on a patient. Anyone that walked in the door, if I had the health department couldn't take care of all people's medical needs. I worked at the sexually transmitted disease program and in reproductive health and addiction medicine. But if I had the tools, money was never an issue. They were a citizen and they paid taxes. And that's how we pay for healthcare, and that's how healthcare should be paid for. But I never had to turn anyone away. But again, if my patients had other needs, then they had to deal with the other part of the healthcare system, which was not set up in their interest.
You, Margaret, were early on part of this group, Physicians for National Health Program, when the whole national healthcare debate was happening in the White House and Congress and Max Baucus and Obama and getting this healthcare bill passed. And at the beginning, it seemed that the whole issue of single payer was a possibility. Obama mentioned it during his campaign. Originally, it seemed like you were going to be invited to the table. What happened? Tell us the story.
Right. I was really looking forward to the health reform process because I thought, oh, we're finally at a point now where the crisis is so serious, and we have a president who knows what single payer is. He said during the debates that healthcare was a human right, that we were actually going to have a debate to discuss what the problems were and the best ways to address them. So I joined with other groups who support the single-payer approach, and we were meeting with members of Congress and leadership and asking them as the process moved forward, would you compare the single-payer proposal to what Congress puts together on the basis of how many are covered and how much it would cost? Because we knew that single-payer would be superior, but as it came down to the times for the hearings, the people that they invited to the table were the people that they called the stakeholders, which was really the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical lobbyists and the CEOs of the insurance companies and big business, and not the patients, not the people that are providing direct patient care. The process was just very heavily influenced by those industries that were profiting off of the current situation, and they didn't want this to be a real debate.
And in fact, it turned out not to be. And the president who had advocated for healthcare as a human right and talked about single payer as a possibility that made sense actively gave up even the public option, which a lot of people had lobbied for as a kind of semblance of some form of single payer for those who need it most. That was scrapped too.
Right. What we found was that the outcome had been determined beforehand. The leadership, meaning the White House and the leadership in Congress, had already pretty much decided what the model was going to be for this health reform. And so they had tried to script the whole process to lead the public. They were doing a beautiful kind of marketing job of trying to lead the public to come to the same conclusion and move the legislation through the committees. And it actually didn't go quite as smoothly as they wanted it to. And we were able to, in some ways, bring single payer to the table, but that took actually standing up and exposing the fact that they were excluding single payer proponents.
During which process you got arrested.
Right.
Tell us that story.
Well, we, as I said, we were meeting with leadership and saying, could we just be included, as you move through this? And when they had the first series of public hearings that was in the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Max Baucus, and we had requested that somebody representing our point of view be asked to testify, and we're talking about people who are experts in health policy and health financing that we wanted to ask to have testify, and they said no, so we had people calling in from the states who had senators on that committee asking them to include single payer in the hearings, and again they said no, so at that point we either felt that we were going to have to give up and say, okay, we've been shut out of this process and it's going to go on without us, or we were going to have to do something about it. And for me, I was so infuriated that this was not a discussion about what our problems were and what the real proven solutions were, you know, would be, that I could not do anything else but stand up. And so eight of us did go to the committee, three physicians and two lawyers and three other advocates, and stand up one by one and say, why aren't we being allowed to testify? And we were each arrested. Now, as a result, I was invited to testify at the next series of hearings, which was the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, which was Senator Kennedy's committee. He was still alive at that point.
And that was a hearing. You were heard, but it didn't really lead anywhere.
Right. It went on the record. I was happy to do that. I was happy to sit next to the CEO of Aetna and explain why the market model of healthcare had failed. And we did testify in each of the committees of jurisdiction in the House. We had some amendments. We did get some, you know, we did get single payer into the discussion somewhat, you know, through the media. But yeah, largely it didn't have the effect that we had hoped for.
But I mean, eventually the people who were hoping for a better healthcare system, it became clear to everyone that this bill was not going to answer the fundamental issues that ail our healthcare system. And then people supported the bill simply because it became an issue for the Democratic Party not to lose face and the president not to be weakened. And the needs of our patients went out the door. I mean, you know, and that's why PNHP has felt that we couldn't compromise what was best for our patients in the interest of political expediency.
PNHP, Physicians for a National Health
Program. Right.
So let's talk about where the money goes. The other day I was having a conversation, we're talking, by the way, to Dr. Margaret Flowers and Dr. Bruce Trigg, about healthcare, about Physicians for a National Health Program, and the New Mexico Network of Health Professionals for National Health Program, which is affiliated with the other organization. I was talking the other day to somebody who is a healthcare expert who said that the CEO of United Healthcare makes $750 million a year, which is approximately $375,000 an hour.
Well, he must have big expenses. Come on.
An hour. Perhaps more than I will ever make in my whole adult life.
It is mind-boggling.
Yeah, and so, I mean, obviously that's one place where our healthcare dollars are going, not to mention the many investors who invest in this quote-unquote growth stock. I mean, have we calculated what the dollar amount is on all the CEOs, all the dividends, and all of that put together?
We have some general sense of the waste in our administrative waste in our system, and it's about $400 billion.
$400 billion in healthcare dollars that don't go to
for administrative, unnecessary administrative costs
and marketing and salaries and profits.
Now, obviously, salaries are necessary, but the unnecessary is the excessive amounts of the on the scale that we were just talking about.
Right. Obscene scale.
I mean, just a simple example, we were invited out to meet with some physicians in Cleveland, Ohio, these two primary care doctors who had been practicing for over 20 years and serving their patients very well, who worked for a nonprofit institution. But they were let go because they were spending too much time with their patients and they weren't generating enough profit for this nonprofit institution. They were given 1 month's notice. And so their patients and their nurses all came together in their community and protested that these physicians made $62,000 a year. The CEO of the hospital made over $600,000 a year. That CEO, who provides no health care, could have funded his salary, could have funded 10 primary care doctors for that community.
Right.
So the less contact you have with patients, the more money you make in our healthcare system. That's the reality.
Now, another place that money goes is there are doctors who are ordering tests because the insurance system demands that they order tests, and also the fear of lawsuit demands that you order tests, even when you don't think they're necessary.
We've gotten ourselves into such a situation in this country where we've really undermined the integrity of the physician-patient relationship. We're reimbursed for the more procedures that we can do rather than actually being able to spend time with our patients. in many things that can be dealt with without tests and medications, but we don't have the time to do that. And that's one of the main reasons that we advocate for the National Health Program, is that it's the only way that we can stop this kind of path that we're on, this very expensive path. We're the most expensive healthcare situation in the world, is to have a system where we can coordinate our healthcare resources and to have the money to pay for that. And the only proven way to do this, to provide comprehensive health care to every person in this country, is to have a single payer, publicly funded, very efficient type of system, where now we're talking about health of our population and not creating profit for those investors.
And it's not a pipe dream, because we have pieces of this already at work within the United States. And the main system is Medicare, which covers
the elderly.
Which is the
archetypal single payer system.
That is our single. The administrative overhead is 3%. 3%. Blue Cross Blue Shields, 20-30% at least. So, and you know, once you hit that magic number, 65 in the United States, you're basically your worries are gone. Now, Medicare still needs to be improved. So we talk about improved Medicare for all as our model for single payer.
So there is a kind of a knee-jerk outcry against anything that results in either socialized medicine or higher taxes. But let's say, just for the sake of argument, that my healthcare premiums, which I share with the radio station, the total amount went toward taxes. And everybody's healthcare premiums that they share with their employers, that they pay on their own if they're freelance or whatever, went toward taxes. Would there be a net savings? I mean, how would that all come out?
Yeah, if we took our current healthcare spending and put it into a organized single-payer system, we can provide lifelong, universal, comprehensive, high-quality healthcare to every person in this country. So rather than doing what we do now, where the amount of money that you spend on healthcare is determined by how much healthcare you need, how many services you need, or the severity of your illness, if we're paying into a system, the system is there for us, and no matter what happens in our life, we don't have to worry about whether we have enough money to pay for that. The system will take care of that. And only about 20% of the population uses the majority of our healthcare dollars. So it's creating a system that's there for us when we need it.
And a system that, in theory, would have an incentive to do preventive care so that there wouldn't be as much illness in the first place.
That has a long-term investment. Health insurance companies have no long-term investment in the people who buy their policies. On average, I think people have plans for maybe 3 years. If you look at the VA has very good outcomes. They have a long-term investment in their population, keeping them healthy.
Let's talk about New Mexico. I mean, part of what has to be shattered is the myth that this country is a country of private insurance in the first place. What about New Mexico? How many people are privately insured versus some of the other systems that we have?
Right. Well, New Mexico is actually the worst case scenario for the private health insurance model, because very few New Mexicans even have private health insurance. At least 70% of the public of the dollars in the health system in New Mexico is public money, but it's all run through, almost all of it is run through a very inefficient and costly private sector. So Medicaid, for example, which covers about 400,000 New Mexicans, is privatized. There are four for-profit managed care companies that get all the managed care, they get all the money for the Salud plans, right? And in fact, when the legislature has asked in bills for an accounting of how the money is spent by the managed care organizations, the governor has vetoed it. Both Governor Richardson and Governor Martinez. Even the legislature doesn't know how the money is being spent.
So what you're saying is Medicare money comes in that's paid into our taxes, and we get
Medicaid,
yeah. And we get a significant match from the federal government for Medicaid. That money comes in to New Mexico as public dollars. It gets delivered to private companies, which in turn skim off a percentage that nobody knows. And the attempt to know is vetoed by Democrats and Republicans alike. And then on the other end of that, there's some health care delivered.
It's even worse than that because they're paid a fixed amount of money per patient called capitation. So the less they do, the more money they make. Now, how can you have a health care system with an incentive of not taking care of people? But that is the clear incentive. And every, you know, people in that business all know it. That's the way you make money.
Well, that's the private insurance model. They're legally bound to create profit for their investors, and the way they do that is by collecting premiums and then restricting and denying care.
You know this. I know this. I think probably all of our listeners know this. Why is it so difficult to get this across to the media and political brain of this nation?
That boils down to the corporate control of our political process and the corporate media. We know that there's what are called interlocking directorates, that people who sit on the boards of major media corporations also sit on the boards of for-profit health industry corporations. And so there's been this concerted effort for decades now to misinform the public and to distract the public. We saw that during the last health reform, where instead of talking about the real problems that we were having, we started seeing things like, oh, this is all because of our aging population, or this is all because of people who use too much health care, all these kinds of distractions that could put out there to keep us from having a real conversation.
And then few people have the time and attention span for following it or bogged down in all these incredible details. There'll be an insurance exchange, and it starts in 2014. In 2017, there'll be, you know, on and on and on. Single payer is very, very simple. Again, the government pays all the bills. You pay the taxes, the government pays the bills. Now you can deal with your sickness and not have to worry about money.
And you choose your health professional, and you and your health
provider.
Professional decide what care you should get, not an insurance middle person. Yeah.
Now, in a case like that, how do you then, okay, you've controlled a lot of unnecessary administrative costs and you've taken the profit motive out of it. Where do you still have a need for cost control if you were to have a single-payer system, and how would you do it?
Right, so a single-payer system has three major ways of controlling our healthcare costs. The first one, as we've talked about, is the administrative simplicity and the fact that more of our dollars would actually go to pay for healthcare. The second is that we would be able to actually negotiate for fair prices for pharmaceuticals and services. One of the ways the United States differs from other industrialized nations is that we don't have a rational way to negotiate for fair prices. As a result, we pay the most for our pharmaceuticals. We pay the highest amount for our healthcare services. So this would allow us to do that negotiation. And then a third way is through actual health planning, through giving hospitals a set amount of money that to take care of the population that they have, and then to actually make sure that our resources are allocated in the areas where they need to be allocated, instead of right now where it's not unusual for one hospital to purchase some sort of technology, and then the neighboring hospital feels that they have to purchase the same technology, and then they start competing, because once you get this expensive equipment, you have to make sure that you have patients there that you can use it on, and it's not about health at that point.
And it's right? a technological arms race.
Right.
You know? I mean, MRI scanners are very expensive, and in many countries, they run 24 hours a day. When I needed my knee scanned, I said, I want the first appointment in the morning. It was like 7 o'clock. Well, maybe we have too many MRI scanners that are vacant at night, and maybe they should be run 24 hours. Or in Albuquerque, several hospitals do open heart surgery. That's not good for patients. There should be one place where all the specialties, you know, all this technology and well-trained people operate.
Why is that?
For a number of very technical procedures, the more you do, the better you are. The more experience the nursing staff has with it, the better the outcomes. So you want to concentrate that. We call it centers of excellence. You know, you want to concentrate that. But to have competing hospitals doing it just because they don't want to be, you know, sharing money, it makes no sense. It's not in the interest of patients.
Dr. Bruce Trigg, you're a retired public health doctor. What are some of the public health problems that we have? childhood obesity comes to mind, and addiction, which is something that you've worked on, that could be in some way helped by having a single payer system.
Right. Those are classic examples of very complex problems that need interventions at many different levels. I do work quite a bit in addiction care, and it's a huge struggle to get coverage for care of addiction, which is a treatable disease. And everyone in New Mexico knows we have a huge problem with heroin, and now a problem with prescribed opiates like OxyContin, and people, some of whom progress to heroin use. This is treatable.
And just plain alcohol.
But these are all treatable diseases. But if there's no healthcare system, or if people don't have health insurance, they can't get coverage. For example, a methadone has been around for 45 years. It's the world standard of care for treatment of opiate addiction. It's not covered by Medicaid in New Mexico. 30 states, Medicaid covers it, not in New Mexico. And this has been brought up, again, I was within the health system for many, within the health department for many years in state government, and we just couldn't get anyone to budge on this.
Why?
Well, again, that money goes through the private sector. And if they don't want to be paying out for methadone, it's somehow they've been able to get the state to sing this, you know, sing the same tune. It makes no sense.
I'm going to ask this question. I've asked it over and over and over on this show, but if we were to have campaign finance reform where corporations did not pay the lion's share of political campaigns, would all this change? Would it change quickly? What do you think?
Campaign finance reform would be, you know, definitely helpful in terms of getting our laws to be based on evidence, you know, sound policy. That's true.
And we're going backwards in that. Actually, the Supreme Court is about to overturn a big part of the Arizona public financing. So we're moving in the wrong direction. It's getting even worse.
So what is the political movement that the two of you are part of, Physicians for a National Health Program? What does that actually look like? What are people doing?
Well, we are Physicians for a National Health Program. It's a 501c3, which means that we primarily educate and advocate for a national health program. But we work very closely with our sister organization, which is healthcare-now.org. And there are chapters of PNHP and of Healthcare Now affiliates all around the country. Our primary focus right now, well, there are a number of different things going on. There are some state efforts to try to pass single-payer legislation at the state level, and Dr. Tribb could certainly tell you about those efforts here in New Mexico. But we also know that this is going to come on the agenda again at the national level within the next possibly 5 years, because we haven't solved our health care problems yet. They're going to continue to grow. So we do have legislation in the House and the Senate at the national level, and a lot of our focus is building up our grassroots base, because we are the majority. The majority of the population supports this. The majority of physicians do. We're a very silent majority. So we're our doctors and our other members, you don't have to be a doctor to join, are going into their communities and educating. We are we see a very close link between the issue of health care and other issues of social and economic justice, because the health is really about more than just access to health care. It's good education. It's a job with a living wage. It's living in a safe environment, those types of things.
And not so, being hungry.
Absolutely, right. Being treated with dignity and respect has a huge effect on our health. So this really is one piece of the broader social and economic justice puzzle. And so this is really a time for the various advocacy groups to come together and push for a broader social and economic justice.
And we've been keeping Dr. Flowers very busy. She came here to be a keynote speaker at the annual New Mexico Public Health Association meeting. And since then, she has spoken to two groups at the University of New Mexico. She's been on radio and TV, and this is our educational effort.
And the students.
To medical students. And most doctors in the United States do support single payer. I mean, people years ago used to be very surprised. Oh, how strange, a doctor who supports this. But many surveys and polls and published articles have shown, including, by the way, New Mexico. The New Mexico Medical Society took a poll online of physicians, not just their members, and the plurality of the group, you know, the largest percent supported single payer. And a couple of months later, they took that copy of the newsletter off the internet. It was never mentioned again. So organized medicine, which is, you know, AMA, which is always opposed single payer, doesn't even represent their own members.
Right.
And that's the reality. And it's becoming increasingly clear, I think.
If people want to get involved, people who are listening to the radio now, what should they do?
Well, they can go to our websites, which are pnhp.org or healthcare-now.org, and you can find there your local contacts for chapters in your area. And you know, join up, get the email alerts, get involved, educate yourself, talk to your friends, family, and neighbors about this. We need to be... We're not going to get the attention on the corporate media, so this has got to be talking person to person and educating ourselves about what we can have in this country, what works.
In New Mexico, we did have a campaign, and we were appreciative to be on the show talking.
Yeah,
about
we had a couple of legislators and a psychiatrist and a student on
that's
here
right.
talking about the campaign.
That's right, and just for your audience to know, this was the Senate bill. Six, I think it was, right, to make the state constitution, to amend it, to include health care as a human right.
Right.
And we got through, Senator Jerry Ortiz Pino was our sponsor, and we got through two Senate committees, but unfortunately never got to the Senate floor.
Yeah.
So we're gearing up already for next year. We're going to take this back because this amendment process is basically a referendum. It's the only way that New Mexicans can actually have a referendum because it goes directly to the voters after it passes the legislature. So we are very interested in, again, raising the level of discussion. Is healthcare a human right? That's the basic, that's the fundamental question we're
right,
asking.
Or is it a privilege?
Is it a privilege? That's right.
Was there a website as part of that campaign?
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, so the website for that is HealthRight, New Mex, NM, HealthRightNM.org.
HealthRightNM.org.
And that has a way to contact us. And again, the network of health professionals for National Health Program is statewide. And we welcome all healthcare professionals, health workers, and concerned citizens.
Doctors, nurses, medical technicians,
everybody.
Patients.
Everybody.
People that
everybody.
Work in the cafeteria.
Everybody.
Right, exactly.
Everybody who needs healthcare.
Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician. She's Congressional Fellow with Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. And Dr. Bruce Trigg is a retired public health doctor, chair of the New Mexico Network of Health Professionals for a National Health Program. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Dr. Andrew Lowe. He is professor at MIT Sloan School of Management and director of the MIT Laboratory for Financial Engineering, and he will be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, the 18th of May at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
So your talk is titled, Can Financial Engineering Cure Cancer, Solve the Energy Crisis, and Stop Global Warming? First of all, what is financial engineering?
Well, financial engineering is the use of mathematical models and tools to solve financial challenges.
And so how are curing cancer and so on financial challenges?
Well, you know, it turns out that much of the really big innovations that face our society today have one thing in common, and that is that they all require resources, but not just money. They require the proper coordination of a number of individuals all acting together for a common cause. And really, financial engineering is the way to structure those kinds of collaborations.
Give us some examples of what that looks like.
Well, if we think back to the Manhattan Project, where we built the atomic bomb in response to threats from Japan and Germany, there were literally thousands of scientists working together for a common purpose. And that was a case where the government stepped in and said, you are going to build this bomb for us. And it was pretty clear that we had to do it because of this external threat. But a lot of the threats that our society faces today are not nearly in the same kind of well-defined category. And so the kind of projects that we have to engage in are much more ill-defined and diffuse. So the issue about climate change and global warming requires coordination among many different countries and even within each country among many different stakeholders. And really, financial engineering is the way to construct proper mechanisms for providing people with incentives to collaborate in an effective manner.
So you gave the example of the Manhattan Project, which is a completely socialized government project. What is an existing example of a, I mean, I assume that when you talk about financial engineering, you're talking about something that's more private sector in general.
Exactly. I mean, take any kind of modern corporation, let's say Facebook. Facebook didn't just happen overnight. It obviously required the collaboration of a lot of individuals. And so that's an example that I think really, you know, bears a further study because it really contains all of the elements of, you know, what we're talking about. Creating any kind of social innovation of a scale of that order of magnitude requires collaboration among lots of different people. And in order to get them to collaborate effectively, you really need to have some mechanism by which everybody is properly incentivized and directed. That's really the idea behind financial engineering. Another example that I'll talk about tomorrow night in my lecture is the so-called DARPA challenge. I don't know if you recall that, but that was a challenge put out by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the United States Department of Defense last year, where they asked individuals to find 10 randomly placed weather balloons across the country. And the first team that could find all 10 would win a prize. And the winning team ended up using some very interesting financial incentives in order to get the crowd to work for them. So this notion of crowdsourcing is really reliant on having proper incentives.
What were the incentives?
Well, I'll talk a bit about that tomorrow, so I don't want to give it all away, but the basic idea was that they structured an incentive mechanism where people who were able to identify balloons were going to get compensated, but it was more than that. It was people that were able to get the word out to others that would also get compensated. So not only would you get paid if you found one of these 10 balloons, but you would get paid a bit less, but nevertheless you would get paid if you told a friend and the friend found the balloon, or if you told a friend who told a friend who told a friend, and that first person at the very end found the balloon, you would actually get paid any place along that chain of communication.
So now we have two examples, DARPA and the Manhattan Project. Both of these are government things.
Oh, no. The DARPA challenge is a challenge that was posed by government, but it wasn't organized by government. It was totally organized by individuals, and in that case, it was something that was done purely at the initiative of the winning team, which happened to be an MIT team. And it was a fascinating story behind it, but it was really all private sector. And many of the other corporations that have done so well over the years, Amazon, eBay, any major effort that requires the cooperation of thousands of individuals really involves some form of financial engineering.
So again, the financial engineering, explain that to us a little bit more. Like, we understand, I mean, when people think about financial, these days they think of the financial crisis, which was caused by deregulation combined with greed and a basic non-caring about human beings, as far as I can tell. And then engineering, we think about MIT and bridges and things like that. And so the two, you don't think of them together.
Well, that's right. And I think that's really where the power of this idea takes hold. It's focusing greed for socially relevant purposes. In other words, using the methods of engineering and then the forces of greed to direct them to socially relevant causes, like cancer, like global warming, like the energy crisis.
Everybody that I know who's working on things like cancer and global warming and the energy crisis are not doing it out of greed. They're doing it because they want to do what's right. And so when you start to combine those things, you're getting really what might be considered a cultural clash.
Well, you're right, and I think that's really where we have to change our thinking, and that's what I'm hoping to do in my talk tomorrow evening. So let me give you an example. In the New England area a few months ago, there was a fundraiser for cancer. It was a very popular fundraiser. A lot of people participated, a number of celebrities. There was an enormous amount of TV time devoted to it. And over the course of a 48-hour period, this fundraising effort did quite a lot of good in raising money and awareness about cancer. How much money do you think this fundraising effort raised during that period of time? It turns out that they raised about $25 million. Now, to you and me, $25 million sounds like a lot of money. But in the challenges of engaging in research and development for cancer drugs, $25 million is a really tiny fraction of a small drop in the bucket. And that's part of the impetus behind the research and the efforts that I'm undertaking now with my collaborators. What we'd like to do is to take the power of financial markets and direct them towards causes like curing cancer, but in ways that will generate tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, think about the scale of the financial crisis. We spent hundreds of billions of dollars on various different bailouts, and yet think about what we could have done if we had only directed some of that money, a small fraction of that, towards these kinds of causes. We spent $40 billion on General Motors, and they weren't even involved in the financial crisis. The AIG, we spent $120 billion. I think that we have to start thinking about those kinds of numbers in dealing with these social challenges.
Where would the money come from? I mean, how are you talking about moving money from whose pockets into whose?
Well, we're talking about doing the same thing that happened in the financial crisis, but for these social causes. So let me give you an example. In the financial crisis, we raised trillions of dollars that were ultimately pumped into the U.S. residential real estate market, right? Through mortgages and mortgage-backed securities and credit default swaps, all of these financial innovations worked extraordinarily well. They worked too well in channeling money from investors around the world into the U.S. residential real estate market. What if we were able to take that same technology and gather those kinds of assets across the world and be able to generate a reasonable amount of return for investors for curing cancer? That would change the entire dynamic of the industry, and that's something that that excites us and we think could actually be an enormously powerful tool for cancer researchers as well as policymakers to wield.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Lowe from MIT. When I looked at your talk, the title of your talk, Can Financial Engineering Cure Cancer, Solve the Energy Crisis, and Stop Global Warming, I was thinking about, what are the causes of cancer and the energy crisis and global warming? It's the very industrial system that you're talking about that creates these horrible byproducts, that creates carbon greenhouse gases and so on. And so it's sort of like using the tools of the machine that caused it to cure it, which historically doesn't have a very good track record.
Well, actually, I'm not sure that that's the case. Let's think a little bit about what the underlying causes are. So ultimately, when we take a look at how we've been able to produce all of these byproducts, it's really through population growth. In 1900, the population of the planet was estimated to be about 1.5 billion people. And as of 2008, that estimate was 7 billion people. We've had a fourfold increase in population in the population of the planet over the course of 100 years, which is an extraordinarily rapid rate of growth. And one question you might ask is, how did that happen? Well, largely it happened because of technological advances. We've been able to squeeze more out of the same natural resources that we had over 100 years ago, and through a variety of breakthroughs in agriculture, in information technology, in medical science, we've been able to deal with a lot of the environmental threats that would have kept our population in check. Those technological innovations have unintended consequences, one of which is global warming, one of which is we're running out of fossil fuels, and another of which is that the financial system has gotten so complex that we now have systemic risks that didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. I'm arguing that we can use the same kind of technologies that created some of those risks to now target those very challenges. We need to get smarter about how we're using financial technology to basically buttress the efforts that scientists and engineers are engaged in to solve these social challenges. I think we can do it.
So let's go back to the example of the actions that led to the financial crisis, these mortgage derivatives and these people in these gigantic banks basically creating situations where they bet on both sides of an issue and won either way, and the people in poor neighborhoods lost and all that that we've talked about at length on this program and so many others. Okay, so you have these investors who want to invest in things where they win no matter what. How would they, I mean, on a really basic level, invest in curing cancer, even as they're, or invest in stopping global warming when it's the same system that creates global warming?
Well, let's go back and ask the question about how so much money was poured into the housing market through these various financial innovations in subprime mortgages. The basic idea there was that we had a pool of relatively unattractive mortgage loans, these so-called subprime mortgages, although there were many other mortgages in that pool. And while each one of these mortgages was not a terribly attractive investment for any given investor, when you pool them into a large portfolio, it turns out that their risks often offset each other. Not always, and we saw in 2007 and 2008, those risks ended up magnifying tremendously, but it was really the dynamics of the risk mitigation mechanism that we were betting on. What if you use that same mechanism to bet on multiple research programs for trying to cure cancer? So we have many different mechanisms and many different compounds that we can try to cure this disease, and actually it's not even a disease, it's multiple diseases, but there may be some common pathways. What if we took all of the various ideas, the very best ideas, and even some crazy ideas, and we all threw them together in a single portfolio, and we then packaged that up in an investment and showed investors what the risks and possible rewards were for that package? What if we could do that and then sell shares on that package? Might it be the case that investors could say, gee, you know, maybe investing in a single cancer drug is not very attractive because we know that's very risky, very expensive, it takes a long time, but I'm willing to invest in a very small piece of 50 different cancer drug trials because I know that one out of 50 is much more likely to hit than any one single trial. If we could do that, then there may be a possibility of raising tremendous amounts of money, not just from U.S. investors, but globally. And if we can do that, we can use the power of the crowd to focus on these kinds of social challenges.
When you talk about cancer drugs and cancer trials, that's one thing. Another strategy for reducing cancer is, for example, clean food, clean environment, doing away with the kind of contaminants that go into water. And here in New Mexico, we have our groundwater contaminated by mining and drilling operations and things like that. Again, you have, when you actually start to address the causes of cancer and not things like cancer drugs and cancer trials, but the causes in the first place, you again are challenging the market system as it exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, we're trying to use the market and the power of the technology we've developed to attack the very problems that may have been created by them. I don't think that that's so surprising because we have the ability to do so. When we first built cars, we didn't think about the exhaust, and then we realized that air pollution is a problem. So we use the same kind of science that we developed for understanding the ability of fossil fuels to engage in locomotion. We use the same scientific principles to figure out ways of creating filters, namely carburetors, that would allow us to take that kind of pollution out of the air. So there are examples where we've used our scientific wisdom to deal with the very problems that were created by those technologies. Technologies are filled with unintended consequences, but I think that we now have a track record of being able to use our collective intelligence to deal with those challenges.
Dr. Andrew Lowe is a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management and the director of the MIT Laboratory for Financial Engineering. And once again, he will be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday the 18th of May at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute, in a talk titled, Can Financial Engineering Cure Cancer, Solve the Energy Crisis, and Stop Global Warming? Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.